Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Did President Trump break the law when he withheld aid to Ukraine? An independent, nonpartisan watchdog group, the GAO, says yes. We'll talk to Gene Healy, joining us on the line, Vice President at Cato Institute. Gene, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
So, Gene, the GAO comes out and says that the Office of the Management and Bureau withheld funds for a policy reason which is not permitted under the ICA, otherwise known as the Impoundment Control Act. What are they talking about?
Well, the Impoundment Control Act was passed in June 1974, right, a month or two before Richard Nixon was driven from office as a result of the impeachment process. Remember, I always have to point out he wasn't actually impeached because he quit before the hammer dropped. But this was sort of the background of what was going on, some of the abuses of executive power in the Nixon administration. Past presidents had used impoundment, had declined to spend funds that Congress appropriated lawfully. But Nixon, it was felt, had gone beyond what his immediate predecessors had done, you know, to the point of really using the ability to hold up funds as a policy weapon, just not to enact programs that he disagreed with. And even though I generally support much lower spending, that's constitutionally problematic. That's what Congress felt in 1974. So it passed the Impoundment Control Act, and, as amended, that act, still allows the president to apply to defer or zero out appropriations, but he has to notify Congress, and Congress has to ultimately vote on it. And what the GAO report says is that wasn't done here, and on top of that, the funds for Ukraine were withheld on what they call a policy ground, which the Impoundment Control Act does not allow.
I know that this has been the GAO has called out a number of administrations over the years. I seem to recall that it occurs a lot more often when one party controls both bodies of Congress as opposed to bipartisan actions that end up in the executive department and the executive violating the ICA. Would that be a fair statement?
Actually, I don't know. I mean, I have seen, references to the GAO has made this conclusion about prior presidents. They did it in the Obama administration at least once, apparently. I should say I don't think this is a showstopper in terms of, new developments in the impeachment fight. I don't think impeachment is ultimately about the violation of statutes. It can be, but people tend to look for, where's the law that the president violated? In many cases, that's just, irrelevant to an impeachable offense, but people seem to think it's important. So this adds a little color to that. But in normal circumstances, a violation of this act, which doesn't carry any criminal penalties, is not something that's you would say is impeachable. I think what the impeachment fight is about is the underlying reason behind the attempt to rescind the military aid to Ukraine. In fact, for GAO to call it a policy reason, they're just using a term of art. The charge isn't that, he just disagreed with the policy. The charge is that he was trying to use that aid as leverage in order to damage a political enemy, which is really not a policy. It's more like a personal use of the powers of the office.
Well, it is fair to say that that was one of the issues, because there were more issues than that, because they talked about corruption in general, not just corruption as it related to Hunter and Joe Biden, correct?
I'm sorry. The I'm not sure about your question. The I'm just saying that the first article of impeachment is focused on, the Ukraine scenario.
Oh, right.
You know, there was the other issue, which I think has been pretty widely debunked now, about whether the Ukraine had Hillary Clinton's server or something. Yes, the Hunter and Joe Biden issue is part of this.
And so really what we have here then is, I guess, a technical violation. There was some discretion on behalf of the president where he could have notified Congress that there were issues that they were trying to work out and asked for some kind of deferment or additional time in order to provide the funding, correct?
Right. But a lot of the reporting suggests that within OMB and within the administration itself, people were scrambling around because this was an unusual request. The certification that the law required the Pentagon to make had already been made by the Pentagon, and they were sort of trying to keep this on the down low. I think it adds a little background and color to the general story. As I say, I don't think an impeachment charge of abuse of power, like Article 1 of the impeachment articles that Congress just passed, is really not about did the president violate a particular federal statute. I think it matters. It puts a thumb on the scale, but I don't think it's transformative in terms of the debate.
Yeah, I was kind of curious because I thought I read somewhere in the OMB, in the GAO report that they had to the end of September to actually provide the funds, and they did so by that date. And I just thought that was kind of curious as well, but I can't seem to lay my hands on that. I've got this report totally highlighted throughout, but it just seemed more so, as you put it, it ends up being more of a technical violation than anything else.
Right. I mean, I wouldn't say the whole thing's a technical violation. I would just say that I look at this in terms of, let's say Hillary Clinton was still serving as Secretary of State when she was running her presidential campaign, and she used the powers of her office to try to dig up dirt or get an investigation announced into her principal political opponent, Donald Trump. I think if the political, if the jerseys, the red and blue jerseys were reversed, I find it hard to believe that the president's supporters would be saying that, oh, nothing to see here, in terms of Hillary Clinton doing the same thing. But I don't think that the technical violation of the statute adds much to that general case. It adds a little weight to the articles, but not much.
Right. Yeah, I found that the statement I was looking for, it said GAO said the appropriation made the funds available for obligation through September 30th of 2019, and I think those funds were actually transmitted or obligated before that time. They have not, as of right now, interestingly enough, been fully transmitted, from what I understand, to Ukraine.
That could be right. As far as the funds being approved at the executive level in early September, what the story from the Democrats is, with some backing, is that around that time, the whistleblower report, news of the whistleblower report was coming out, and that the funds were actually obligated as the scheme came apart, not because the president decided independently that his concerns about Ukraine and the Bidens were met.
Yeah, let me ask you. You've been around a while. Is it unusual to have like OMB be at odds with DOD over a particular issue, or DOD be at odds with some other branch of government over an interpretation of a rule or otherwise?
Well, my reading and the reporting on what was going on in OMB is that people within OMB and people within the Pentagon were worried about whether they could legally do this precisely because of the Impoundment Control Act. So I think the whole thing is rather unusual. That's not to say that there aren't occasions in the past where presidents have tried to hold up funds for genuine policy reasons.
I asked that question, let's say, with the backdrop of what's going on in immigration, whether or not some of the defense funds can be used for national homeland security purposes at the southern border. There were those inside of all of these institutions that said, some said yes, some said no. Ultimately, it ends up getting approved. The courts have actually embraced it. There are those that in the media that are trying to make this big thing out of this disagreement. Having worked in government myself for 40 years prior to this gig, I didn't find that there was anything unusual about different organizations within a governmental structure not agreeing with one another.
I don't find that aspect of it unusual. I do think the nature of the request and what people seem to have understood to be the reason behind it.
I get all of that. Yeah.
That is unusual.
Yeah. No,
I would hope it's unusual.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I would agree. I would agree with you there. They just seemed to hone in on this disagreement between OMB and DOD. And it's like, I would bet to say that they have a disagreement about an issue almost every day. I mean, of this nature, but it's going to be of other technical language, technicalities, or whatever it may be.
Yeah, the federal budgetary process is complicated, and there's room for interpretation. As I say, I don't think that this is, the fact that the statute was violated is neither necessary nor sufficient, I think, for the abuse of power case.
Gene, you and I talked the other day about this impeachment process, and obviously they're still going back and forth on whether witnesses ought to be had or otherwise. Is it the obligation of the Senate to actually go about doing that as opposed to, when you think about the other impeachment processes that were had where you had a special counsel or otherwise appointed, they had every opportunity to call these same witnesses before the House and they chose not to do so. They said that it was an emergency, they had to hurry up. There was some exigency. They had to get this done. They couldn't wait for these witnesses. Then they held them. And now they're kind of trying to shift this burden to the Senate.
Senators take an oath to do impartial justice before the Constitution and the laws of the land. That's the specific oath they take for the Senate trial. And, as we discussed, the trial is supposed to happen in the Senate. The House was hamstrung. In large part because the actual fact witnesses, people like the Chief of Staff Mulvaney, John Bolton, and others, people with direct knowledge of what the president was up to, were prevented from testifying by the president. So it is a little bit like, the guy who kills his parents and throws himself on the mercy of the court as an orphan for the Republican Party to say now that they didn't do their job because they should have had Bolton and, they should have had a full dress trial in the House, which is really like a grand jury proceeding. So we can't hear from witnesses in the Senate trial. I mean,
but isn't it a little disingenuous to say, isn't it a little disingenuous to say we need to rush the impeachment, the filing of the charge? But you don't need to rush the trial. we didn't want to go deal with all the machinations of overcoming the hurdles of privilege or otherwise during the investigative process, but we're asking you to do that during the trial process. We needed to rush, but y'all don't need to rush.
Well, I don't think anyone wants the trial to last 6 months, but as far, you know, as I said...
But by the same token, if the Senate has to go...
There's a target-rich environment for hypocrisy, you know, in this whole affair, but as to which side is, you know, the complaint at the House was hearsay. Okay, can we hear from the fact witnesses? No, executive privilege. So I think there's plenty of hypocrisy on both sides. People have to make their own judgment as to, you know, which side has the bulk of it. But they
know for a fact that the Senate doesn't have the authority to dispense with these privileges. It has to go to the third branch of government, the judiciary. And that's where
it doesn't have to. John Bolton can testify, and the president has no enforcement mechanism to get executive privilege enforced in the Senate. And on top of which, he hasn't really made an executive privilege claim. He's made like a witch hunt privilege claim. There's been no formal claim of executive privilege. I don't even think the words appear in.
You're making my case. Well, then why not have him go before, you know, the House in the impeachment process? What if he is to say, we never had a conversation that y'all are alleging actually occurred, and that was never contemplated? So that would be exculpatory evidence that should be revealed prior to charging an individual.
Well, that's not the way it ever works in a grand jury. If the grand jury's the analogy, you have the trial. You know, you don't even have a right. You can be facing criminal charges. You don't even have a right to as a grand jury target. You don't even have a right to testify.
I understand, but there's no basis in law to say that the House works as a grand jury in this impeachment process.
Well, the entire process is underspecified in the Constitution, but the Constitution does say the trial's in the Senate. And
you and I talked about that the other day. In fact, everybody's calling the senators jurors. And I think you said, Rehnquist said, no, they're not actually jurors, they're judges.
They're the court, I believe he said. Yeah,
they are the court, and everyone is treating them as though they are jurors. Jurors don't have the benefit of manipulating process or having something to say about process in a court, which judges do, and these individuals, the senators, can change the process. They can make the process whatever they want.
Sure, they can, and there will be no recourse. There's not going to be a Supreme Court decision that says go back and do it again because you didn't meet the constitutional standards. The constitutional standards are very much in flux. But as I said, they do take an oath to do impartial justice, and it seemed to me that would require hearing from the fact witnesses. If the phone call was in fact perfect, and if the motivations around it were perfect, why not hear from John Bolton?
Yeah, I mean, I just, as an investigator myself for 40 years, I was the sheriff. We would take, you know, Brady material, exculpatory material, and inculpatory material, and present all of that to the charging body, the district attorney, before we move forward with the prosecution of a case. You know,
case has moved forward yesterday, so that's not where we are.
No, it's not. I mean, I just find it disingenuous, and as you've said it very well a couple of times about the level of hypocrisy up there and how they're characterizing. What are the obligations of these bodies? And they seem to conflate a whole lot of different issues because not a single Democrat has referred to the senators as judges. It's all as jurors. And I think they're completely missing the boat.
Well, if there were jurors, yes, it would be difficult. I mean, they can't be sequestered, and they, as a practical matter, can't really be forced to recuse. They could, in theory, but it's never happened. Forced to recuse for biases. You know, this is a mixed operation of law and politics, and
the next criticism is going to be if they refuse to comment on any of what they've heard. It's rare that you ever see a judge comment on the evidence that's presented before them. So if they're truly acting as judges, they really shouldn't be addressing the media at any point in time during the course of this impeachment process.
That's true, but it has never worked that way. I mean, even when people were complaining about Mitch McConnell coordinating with the president, the same thing happened on the other side in the Clinton trial. The same thing happened in the Andrew Johnson trial. So you're not going to see a politics and partisanship-free impeachment trial of any significant figure. Again, if you want to see a nonpartisan, bipartisan impeachment that's looks more like a trial, you're going to have to look for obscure federal judges. In fact, in New Orleans, the last judicial impeachment, the Porteous, trial in 2010, that, my recollection is, was overwhelmingly bipartisan.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. So, but when the stakes are high, politics gets the upper hand in this mixed operation of law and politics.
Absolutely. Gene Healy, thank you again for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend. Gene Healy, Vice President at the Cato Institute. Hope we brought a little bit more information forward about this process and what it means. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.